I'm feeling somewhat overwhelmed by the comments and questions that many of you have asked. So it was only just a little over an hour left to cover all these bases is going to be quite a challenge. But if you will just bear with me for a moment, I want to cover as quickly as possible some issues that have been raised during the break, and then move into some of the material that I do want to share with you. And if you still have comments or questions about it, we'll take them toward the end if they don't bear directly on what I'm going to be speaking about. The question has been asked as to whether reactive depression can become endogenous depression. It's a very common belief in some medical circles that if you're endogenously depressed for a long time, sooner or later it will become an endogenous depression. There's absolutely no truth to that. We're talking about totally different mechanisms. And an endogenous depression is a specific defect in the neurotransmitter, and while stress can trigger it, I'm going to talk about that in a little while, while stress can trigger it, by and large, reactive or the psychological depression does not itself cause the other one. If the medication works, you have the endogenous problem. Someone has asked about the contribution of, say, abuse early in life to later endogenous depression. Yes, early life abuse is a stressor. And anything that raises your stress level, if you have the defect, is going to kick it in. Which is why lowering your stress level is a very, very important management strategy for those with endogenous depression. Someone asked about ADD, adult attention deficit disorder. My honest opinion is that it is overdiagnosed. It's the current fad. Everybody with any sort of problem is being labeled ADD, AADDD, DDDDDD. And I think it's overdiagnosed. I think where we have a problem today is a problem of discipline, a loss of control. I think that everyone's going off in their own direction. Kids are not compliant anymore. That's the problem. And you can prescribe massive amounts of Ritalin, and it's not going to fix the problem. Now, they are legitimate attention deficit disorders, so don't misunderstand me. But my feeling is that it is overdiagnosed, and so you really need to get if you have a child diagnosed that, get another opinion, get 10 opinions. And if one of those 10 says it's not, then go with that one, okay? postnatal depression. Anything that impacts the reproductive system for women is likely to cause depression. However, in postnatal depressions, we're not always looking at the defect in the neurotransmitter. What we're having is an imbalance in the whole endocrine system. And I will come back in a moment to talk. There are many disorders in the endocrine system that can cause depression. That's not this thing I'm talking about, endogenous depression. It's not that at all. It's biochemical depression. And a competent psychologist or psychiatrist or physician will first of all rule out the physical causes of depression. One of the things you have to check is the functioning of the thyroid gland. The thyroid gland is notoriously capable of producing profound depression. When the thyroid gland is underactive, you get a very unique form of depression, and you have to rule that out first. There's a lot of physical conditions. If you turn back in your outline to point number 12, and I'll just dispose of that now, physical causes of depression. Many diseases cause depression. Most of the cancers are depression producing. Many of the drugs used to treat disease are depression producing. And if you're on a drug and you're feeling depressed, then check with your doctor. Is it possible that one of the side effects of the drug is depression? Treatment of high blood pressure in men using what is known as a beta blocker, like propranolol, one of its side effects is depression. So So if you're being treated for high blood pressure and you're feeling depressed, chances are it's the medication that's causing the depression. You don't have to look any further than that. Go back and have your medication changed. Burnout is a cause of depression. We'll talk about that tomorrow morning, because that is a very unique form of depression that we experience in ministry. Stress as a cause of depression, and I'm going to come back to that in a moment, but tonight I'm talking about stress. Stress is a very significant trigger of endogenous depression. It also produces a unique form of depression, which is adrenal exhaustion. Adrenaline exhaustion. It's a very, very unique type of depression. But stress can trigger endogenous depression, in that stress kicks in that mechanism, that defect in the neurotransmitter, and then it can also cause depression at the level of adrenaline that's exhausted, not enough adrenaline. And the post-adrenaline depression is a mild form of that, which we experience on a weekly basis. Once the weekend is over, we go into that mild depression. And I've mentioned endocrine dysfunction. The thyroid gland particularly has to be watched. So those are all factors. And postnatal depression is primarily upset in the biochemistry of the endocrine system, of which there's a whole bunch of glands, and obviously sometimes it triggers the endogenous depression. Now, what is important to understand is that this is not an all or nothing phenomenon. In other words, it's not either one or the other. I have, for sake of clarification, described psychological depression on the one hand, and then biological or endogenous depression on the other hand. But it stands to reason that in most depressions, what you have is some of this and some of that. And the question is, which is the dominant? Is it dominantly psychological, or is it dominantly biological? And when you have both equally, it's called a double depression. And I just want to take a moment to say a few things about double depression. It stands to reason that if you have an endogenous depression, that is going to interfere with your capacity to cope with life. You're not going to handle people very well. You're not going to be very patient. Your mood is depressed already. You don't have the energy. So consequently, because of this loss of energy, and by the way, the symptoms of depression, there are three cardinal symptoms. I mean, we could go through a long list. A person who's crying all the time is depressed, sadness. But of the three cardinal symptoms, the most important one is this loss of energy or lethargy. And that's why it is so often overlooked. Most people who say, oh, I never get depressed, they mean, oh, I never go and cry and sob and sob and cry and sob. No, that's only one aspect of depression. But do you ever feel profoundly tired or fatigued? Oh, sure, sure. That's depression. So, clinically speaking, this is the most important symptom you look for. A person says, you know, until about 3 months ago, I had lots of energy, I could cope with things, and suddenly I can't get up in the morning, I can't lift my arm, everything feels heavy, I can barely put my feet on the ground. That is a clinical symptom of depression, lethargy. Now, that loss of energy is the one. The second major symptom is loss of interest in normal activities. You've got a hobby and you like that, and suddenly you're not interested. Loss of interest is the second one. And then the third one is the sad mood. But it's third in order of importance. But most people think it's the most important, because when in a severe depression, that's the one we see the most. But these others are also important. There's a whole host of other symptoms. Loss of self-esteem. Your guilt. People in depression also have a lot of guilt feelings. I feel guilty about everything. I feel guilty about my kids. I feel guilty. And then the ultimate one is, you know, the obsession that you've committed the unpardonable sin. And you get a person obsessed about the unpardonable sin, chances are that they are depressed. The chances are high. But these losses here give rise to more loss reactively or psychologically. And that then causes the psychological, or we call it reactive depression, which is now superimposed on the endogenous. Now you've got a mixed bag. You've got fruit salad here. And you don't know what is apple and what is orange or banana or anything else. And so double depression is invariably the consequence. Anyone who is biologically depressed is likely to become reactively depressed as well. Which is why, although this component is best treated by antidepressant medications, which are God's gift to us in our day and age to deal with the biological defect here, that often if you only do that and you still have this, the person will still seem to be depressed. Which is why the best treatment combines the antidepressant with the therapy, and usually cognitive therapy is the best. Because depression distorts our thinking. And so anyone who then can help you sort out your thinking and keep your thinking straight will minimize this reactive depression, stop this chain of feeding into it. Now I want to talk about how you can tell the difference between endogenous, and I'm looking in the outline where I have that as a heading. Can anyone see it anywhere? Page 4. I don't see it. Number 8. Thank you. There we go. No, it's not number 8. Yes. No, that's, yes, number 8. Number 8. Go back to point number 8. Perhaps the biggest challenge we have as pastors in helping people who are depressed, because understand this, that very often, you will be the person's first line of consultation, right? That often the person depressed, you believe God has shut you out, you can often see it as a spiritual problem, so who do you go to? Go to the pastor. And the pastor needs to be able to look and discern, is this a spiritual problem? And often it is. Don't misunderstand me. Often a lot of spiritual problems give rise to losses that make people depressed. They have failed in some way. Maybe there's a really significant sin in their life. And so one needs a lot of discernment as well as good diagnostic ability to ensure that you're not dealing with a spiritual problem, because spiritual problems can give rise to psychological depressions just as much as losses in life can, because it's loss, it's still a loss. So you should be able to discern the spiritual component from the psychological. But then in looking at the depression, how can we differentiate the endogenous or biological from the reactive? And there are some very helpful pointers that I'd like to just go through with you. The first thing to understand about the difference between reactive and biological, and it's clinically it is about the best indicator there is, and that is that in reactive depression, you wake up in the morning and for a brief period of time it feels like everything is okay. And as the day progresses, the depression gets worse. My daughter, in her recent bereavement, I was talking to her one day and seeing how she was doing, and she said, "You know, Dad, I'm having a strange sort of thing." She says, I wake up in the morning and I open my eyes and I say, "What a wonderful day. God bless. Thank you for blessing me." And I look out of the window and I see the trees and I, I hear the birds, and I hear my boys playing in the other room, and my heart is so full with praise to God. And then I remember. And I touch the other side of the bed, and it's empty. See, the thing about reactive depression is that the depression has to constantly be renewed, refreshed. Good analogy comes from computers. In certain types of memory chips in computers, the memory will only work if there's a refresher pulse. So memory is constantly being refreshed. That's how the brain works, by the way. That's exactly how the brain works. Constantly the memory is being refreshed. If you don't refresh it, it forgets it. And a good sleep, a good night's rest, the brain forgets temporarily. And losses have to be recreated almost on a daily basis to experience the depression. And so her description is a very accurate one. And then I remember. But even if you remember at the moment your eyes open, even if you remember at that instant your eyes open, the principle is still the same. You feel better in the morning with reactive depression. And as the day progresses, the day, the memories flood back, the things you remember, you think. Thinking is deadly. Bad habit, thinking. You should give it up. And then the depression begins to return again. Now that's reactive depression. Contrast that with endogenous depression. Because it's biological, whether you think about it or not, it's there. It doesn't need refreshing. So when you wake up in the morning, in fact it's the exact reverse. You wake up in the morning, the depression is worse first thing when you wake up. Sleep makes endogenous depression worse. And then as the day progresses, it feels a little better. Even in the most severe depressions, the real bizarre manic depressive or psychotic depressions where the person is agitated and can't sit still, it's always worse in the morning. If you follow them through the day, you'll see that as the day progresses, by late afternoon, they're calm, they're peaceful. And a person says, you know, evening's my best time. In the evenings, depression doesn't seem to be so bad. But when I wake up in the morning, it is horrible. It's terrible. Don't want to get out of bed. I'm angry at God because He didn't take me during the night. Lots of depressed people go to bed. Their prayer is, God, take me in my sleep. Take me. Just take me out of this. Free me from this. And then I wake up and I'm still awake and I'm angry at God. And that's endogenous depression. It's worse in the morning, gets better through the day. So that's a very helpful. It's called the diurnal variation of mood, is what it's technically called. Worse in the morning, better as the day progresses. But there are some other factors that differentiate a reactive from endogenous depression. Because reactive depression is a response to loss, we usually expect to find some significant loss in the recent history of someone who is reactively depressed. There's got to be some reaction. Certainly you talk to somebody and they can't recall anything. There's been no change of job. I mean, there are lots of things that can represent loss. I'm aware of the fact that we have students here. And I often wonder about the students. It's interesting, whenever we accept into our clinical psychology program pastors who are moving into that field, I predict that about 50% of them will be depressed for at least a year. So I make a point of going out to talk to them, because for many of them, leaving ministry to go into another profession like mine is a tremendous loss for them. Now, they're not aware of the fact. They invest so much into their identity as a pastor, and now they're just a student again. That identity is all gone, and they go into a deep depression. But I'm also thinking of some who come out of very lucrative jobs and careers, who go into ministry, who in the early stages of studying, you know, it's hard, it doesn't look like it's so very glamorous, and I wonder how many of them go through reactive depression as they face the face up to the fact that they've given up so much. You know, gone back to being poverty-stricken again as students, or and there are many situations that produce loss. And the important thing in reactive depression is, of course, to get that out in the open. But the point I'm trying to make is that in reactive depression, there is always an identifiable loss. Now, how far back does one look? You know, it's possible that someone experienced a significant loss 5 years ago, didn't grieve it adequately, and now you're faced with another loss again. Similar sort of loss. Now, the present loss makes you, may be a small one only, but it's enough to recreate the loss from that previous that hasn't been grieved. So if you're not careful, what you do is you accumulate ungrieved losses that you've never dealt with. Now, every time you experience another loss of a similar kind, you are not just grieving this loss, you're grieving all these ungrieved losses, which is why grief work is so important. I was speaking at a Focus on the Family training conference once for pastors and counselors, and I was talking on depression and reactive depression and the need for grief. And at the end of the session, I noticed there was a lady in a wheelchair, a younger woman sitting up front, and while I was speaking, she started to cry. I could just see she was upset about something. And afterwards, she came to talk to me, and she said, "You know what, I've been in a wheelchair now most of my life. I was crippled as a very young child." She said, "All these years, I have never grieved the loss of my limbs. Never grieved it. I've just set it aside. Just forgotten it." But what's happened is that she had become predisposed to depression. She could handle almost no loss anymore. All traceable back to the fact that her major significant loss is something she's never grieved. And so, but there's always in reactive depression, there is always some sense of loss that one can identify. It may take a lot of skill to discover it, but usually there is. And I'm going to say more about that, because I think that's the real challenge for us, is how do we help people get in touch with their loss, their losses? And then what do we do to grieve them? Also in reactive depression, another important difference between reactive and endogenous is that endogenous depressions are usually much more severe and incapacitating than reactive depression. Put it another way, the more serious the depression, the greater is the probability that it is endogenous. Furthermore, in biological depression, the loss of energy, we refer to it as a vegetative state. You're just a vegetable. The vegetative state is very profound in endogenous depression. It's a central depressing event. A reactive depression, you can go and play a game of tennis and win. But in endogenous depression, no way. No way. Unless it's mild. I mean, you get milder forms of endogenous depression, but by and large, in reactive depression, there's the absence of these vegetative symptoms. And then lastly, because we could go on all day just talking about the differences, but I do want to mention the fact that in reactive depression, it is possible to distract the person who is depressed out of the depression. In endogenous depression, don't waste your time. You can distract. Because it's reactive, if you can just distract the mind so it stops this refreshing thing, the depression lifts a little bit. You can say to someone who is in grief, of being fired, of a child who's left home, I guess some examples of losses in a little while that caused reactive depression. But in most of those cases, you can go to someone like that and you can say, "Let's go to a movie. Let's go to a footy game. Let's go and have some fun. Let's go play golf. Let's go for a walk." And the person may resist at first. Don't be put off by the initial resistance. But when they get to do it, you notice that they lighten up. that they feel better, that they act in a more normal way. And they'll say to you, "Yeah, well, thank you for that. You know, for a while I was able to forget and I felt better." If I can forget and feel better, it's not endogenous. And so distraction is helpful for people in reactive depression. Provided the distraction doesn't stop the grieving process. There's a distraction that brings the grief to a halt. That's bad. But relief, it's nice just to have a little relief every now and again. Endogenous depression, nothing you can do. You can say to someone endogenously depressed, "Listen, if you'll smile, I'll give you $10 million. Here it is, here's a check for $10 million. Just smile and be happy for 5 minutes, and you're going to have $10 million. Couldn't do it. They wouldn't be interested in the money. That's the nature of endogenous depression. Do you get the feel? I hope you're getting the feel of what I'm... I don't have $10 million, so don't come and see me afterwards. Nothing I can do for that. All right, let's move now into dealing with how do we deal with reactive depression. Before I move away from endogenous, any other questions or comments about biological depression? Let's take that before we move into the other. Is it always that they must be on medication? If the medication works, the chances are you should be on it the rest of your life. Because although it comes in episodes, the chances are that it will come back again, and it takes at least 3 to 4 weeks before the medication takes effect. So you could have, it will take you about a month after you start the depression again before you will own up to it. And another 3 to 4 weeks before the medication. There's 2 weeks, 2 months of misery. If you continue the medication, you will probably never have another episode. So the growing preference, and I'm not sure that that's true in Australia yet. Message I'm getting here from a lot of people is, "No, my doctor wants me off this medication as soon as possible." And they are usually GPs who are accustomed to dependent drugs, addicting drugs. Which is true. You get people off addicting drugs as quickly as possible, and they don't really make the adjustment that antidepressants are not addicting. You've got to have periodic blood tests to make sure that there's no damage to the liver. But as long as that is all done, you stay on the rest of your life. Forget about it. It's a vitamin pill. Just take it and enjoy your life over here and then. Okay, yeah, with manic depression, I should really have mentioned it. There's a very unique form of depression that is called, used to be known as manic depression, but now it's called bipolar, meaning that one goes from depression, deep depression, endogenous depression, to this mania. Now, Kath and I were in a shopping mall over the weekend, and they had a public activity going on, and this lady was lecturing to the two or three people who were sitting there about depression, and she got to talk about manic depression. And she said, as an example of who is a manic depressive, she said, if you've ever watched Fawlty Towers, Basil Fawlty is an example of manic depression. I stopped in my tracks. I said, "Lady, you don't know what you're talking about. He is a cyclothymic. He's up and down. He's up, he's explosive, he's down." That's not manic depression. Manic depression is a very unique, extreme depression to extreme mania. Let me tell you what the mania is. I had a patient once, a wife of a physician that I had to hospitalize for manic depression, and she had just the depression. And we put on the medication, and 2 weeks later, it often happens in a severe depression, when you put them on the antidepressant, they do a flight into health, and they go straight from the depression 2-3 weeks later into mania. You've got to watch it very carefully. And the psychiatrist who was consulting for me said, insurance has run out, I've got to discharge her from the hospital, but she's out of the depression, that's fine. I said, no. I see signs of mania developing, and I don't want her discharged yet. And he said she had to be discharged, and we had a bit of a debate, and finally he won, and we had to discharge her from the hospital. The day we discharged her, she got in her car, drove from Pasadena, the hospital where we worked, across to a city over Glendale, and on the way home, she noticed that all the street signs were pointing in the wrong direction. She is 65 years of age, parked her car in front of the street signs, climbed up into the top of her car to reach up to the street signs to turn them around because they pointed the wrong way. And every street sign on the way home, she turned around. And when she got home, she sat down to write a letter to the president at that point to complain about these street signs all pointing in the wrong direction. Now, this is a perfectly sane, normal lady, normally. But that's mania. Grandiose plans and schemes. Can't get to sleep at night because you're dreaming up. It's bizarre, is what I'm trying to say. That's mania. A person who is up and down in mood, mild mood swings like a Basil Fawlty, it's not manic depressive. Now, there's a tendency to think that that mood swing like this is the precursor to manic depression. It's nonsense. The people who become manic depressives are calm, easygoing, even-tempered people, and suddenly the defect kicks in. And then they go into this manic depression. And the depression doesn't just last a few hours or a few days. It lasts for weeks or even months. And then it may return to normal and then goes all the way into mania. Now that form, that bipolar disorder, is treated with a different medication. Until recently, the only medication we've had is lithium carbonate. It's about the cheapest medication there is. It's just an ordinary salt you go and mine in the mine somewhere. And it treats the mania. There are a lot of people, there's one type of bipolar. See, once you know there's mania, you know you have bipolar, called bipolar 1. But there's a bipolar 2, a second type of bipolar disorder, now recognized, where all you see is the depression. But you know that somewhere in the future there will be a manic episode. And so you bring in the lithium at an earlier point to prevent that manic episode at a later point. It's fairly easy to treat. It's not difficult. But it is also a biochemical disorder. It's not that up-down mood stuff. That's neurotic, not depression. Yes. 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 A person who is depressed and then gets a thought and it stays there for months. It is very common in severe endogenous depressions for these people to develop obsessions, and almost delusional obsessions, that, you know, get an obsession where they can't get a thought out of their mind, and then the obsession becomes delusional. The delusional obsession would be that the FBI is trying to kill me. I'm depressed. I'm sad about that. I'm crying all the time. But the delusion, or the delusion that I've committed the unpardonable sin, or and on and on. And that is obsession, and there's another medication that's used for that obsessional component. You use it in addition to the depression. No. Oh, you mean to take it? No, usually that isn't. Once you just treat that until it goes away, and then you stop the medication. Usually with that. It's not a lifetime thing. Yes. There was a time, is there a way to test medically for endogenous depression? There was a time when it seemed like they had developed a test. And for a period of time, I sent everyone with a major serious depression in for the test. It's called a dexamethasone suppression test, or DST. And for a while, it seemed like if you got a positive finding on that test, the person would absolutely, positively respond to the medication. But the trouble was that even if you got a negative finding, 60% of people still responded to the medication. So it's one of those tests. You can give it, and if you get a positive test, you can bet on it. But if you get a negative test, it could still be that they need medication. So it failed to be a clear on or off again. And that's the only one that has been developed. Right now, we don't have reliable. The only reliable test we have is diagnosis by trial medication. The best diagnosis we have is try the medication. If it works, you've got it. If it doesn't work, you don't have it. You've got something else. Right at the back. There is no evidence that endogenous depression is on the increase except for the contribution that stress is playing. There is a growing body of evidence that stress is on the increase, and that with higher levels of stress, people who have the defect are succumbing to it. In other words, there are a lot of people, a lot of us have inherited the defect, but we're never going to get depressed. Until our stress level goes sky high. And then one of the consequences of that is that defect, that you push the nervous system to its limits, and that system fails you and kicks in the depression. And that's the only evidence. And I want to address that more when I talk about stress. Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. The serotonin, the SSRIs are perfectly safe. All medications are ranked in a ranking of 5 in terms of whether they're safe or hazardous for having a baby. And so if the doctor can tell you this is a level 3 medication. If it's level 1, it has no risk whatsoever. 5 maximum risk. And Prozac, for example, is a level 1. There's no evidence whatever that it affects your... Now, the problem is after the baby is born, if you breastfeed the baby, then there's some concern about passing the drug on to the baby through your milk. But that is usually something you evaluate on... If the profession is not very serious, you stop the medication. By the way, I said that you shouldn't stop Prozac. I mean, don't stop it for 2 or 3 weeks and then try to take it again because it probably won't work. If you stop it, you have to stop it for 6 months. And then only restart it. Two more questions and I need to move on. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Once the medication takes effect, you've got the right medication, the right dose, and often they have to be combined. I mean, the skill here in the person who prescribes is combining these medications, because you want the benefit of this one, but you want to take it at a lower dose, and some of these medications have the effect of amplifying the others. You take this one with this one, and you can take them at a lower dose because the combination excuse me, is more powerful than just one of them. And you can go back to full normal life. It's behind you. It's finished. Done with. Get on with your life. There was one last question over there, and then I'll move on. Yes. There's a very close connection between sleep disorders and depression, and the problem is that it goes both ways. I'm going to suck something for my throat, if you don't mind. Can I suck and talk? I think I can. It's a question of whether you can tolerate me doing it. I'll try to do it silently. What was the question again? Sleep disorders. Yes, a very close connection. Most often, severe depression increases sleep, but minimizes the dream state, and that's bad for us. So that we have a bit of a problem. The most common sleep disorder in depression is early morning wakening. You get to bed, you fall asleep immediately. And then you wake up 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and you can't get back to sleep. It's called terminal insomnia. And sleep terminal insomnia. It comes at the end, it's not sleep onset, it's sleep terminal. And it can be a real problem. Fortunately, the antidepressants, now this is where the serotonin reuptake inhibitors don't help us. If you take Prozac, you've got to take it in the morning. If you take it in the evening, you'll never get to sleep. You've got to take it in the morning, single dose. And so you will often go back to the older antidepressants, the tricyclics, because they are sedating. They're one of their side effects. But we use the side effect to our advantage. And you take the tricyclic last thing at night, one dose, before you go to bed, and that helps the sleep component of it. And we'll restore it. So often if there's a sleep disturbance, by adjusting the medication, you can take care of that and have the benefit of both. Right, turn now to, in the outline, to point 13. I'll pick up at point 13. And I know I'm not talking about, forget about endogenous, forget about medication, all that stuff. We're not talking psychological depression, reactive depression, because this is the most common one. This is everybody's problem. And it's a response to loss. But the first thing we have to understand about loss is that loss is something we attribute to an event. Loss is something we attribute to an event. This is a very important point to grasp, that we attribute loss. I can lose something that has no meaning for me, and it makes no difference. It doesn't make any difference. If every student in our program resigned and ran away, of course it would be a loss, but you get my point. We attribute loss. It's something has to have meaning before it's a loss. Not everything we lose is a loss. It has to do with meaning. And meaning is an attribution. So there's a whole body of theory that's developed called attribution theory. And it's very helpful. Because some of the ways in which there's some losses we experience that put us into a deep depression. There's no grief to be done. There's no grief work to be done. What you're going to do is change your attribution of loss. If a certain congregation doesn't care much for your preaching, is it a loss issue or is it an attribution issue? And sometimes we have to pull back and ask ourselves, whose opinion is it? Whose opinion is it that my preaching is not acceptable or that my ministry is not good? And when you pull back and you examine your attributions, you realize it's not God's opinion. And so I must emphasize that is an important step in the process. Attribution. Now, having examined the attribution of loss, the meaning of the loss, we then come to the conclusion, yes, it is an important loss. It is a loss. In death, for example, the loss is not attribution, right? It's fact. But in all other losses in life, attribution plays some role. And a healthy-minded person is able to take care of attribution. And that portion of Scripture in Philippians 3, the Apostle Paul, from verse 7, whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss. You know what the Apostle Paul was saying? You're not going to take it away from me. I've given it up. If I give it up, you can't take it away from me. That's an attribution thing. And you know, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. That's an attribution thing. Give it up. Let it go. Let your reputation go. Forget about it. It's all a matter of opinion. That's a very useful phrase. It's just their opinion. You don't like what I'm saying. It's just your opinion. And so work at that attribution stuff, first point. But now let's assume that the depression is genuine. The loss is genuine. It means something. And where do we go from there? There is an ideal way of responding to legitimate loss. And it goes something like this. Imagine that we're going along. I always diagram depression as going downward. By the way, if you want one of my books that is not too expensive and covers all of this, my book Dark Clouds, Silver Linings, published by Focus on the Family, is a good single resource. The other one is a book called Counseling the Depressed. That is much more of a counseling focus, a little bit more technical, but covers all the material that I'm sharing with you now. I see depression as going downward. Now, the ideal way to experience depression is this is the point of loss. To allow yourself to go into a depression and to go into it as deep as is appropriate. Come to terms with the loss, release the object, whatever it is, release it, and then recover from the depression and go on your way. That is how we are designed to respond. It's the ideal way of dealing with it. Now, it's ideal. they have a couple of complicating problems when you deal with real people. The first is that often the loss here is not it's not when the actual loss takes place, it's when you perceive the loss. Someone might say something to me one day, and 3 days later I'm having a sleepless night and I'm lying there and I'm thinking about what this person said. And then I realize they criticized me. Never dawned on me before, right? So it wasn't when they said the words that I experienced the loss. It's when I thought about it. The perception of the loss. When I left South Africa, the engineering company that I worked for gave me a pair of gold cufflinks that I just, I prized them. They were gold, and gold is always good. Gold is good. That's a good phrase. But I love them. But for a long time, I couldn't get shirts that had the holes in, that you could use them. They stopped making them. But one day, I got myself a shirt tailored, and it had the holes, and I wanted my gold cufflinks so I could wear them. And I went to my drawer to look for them, and they weren't there. Couldn't find them. Lost them. I might have melted them down in my sleep or something. But then the interesting thing about it was that I probably mislaid them 2 years before, but I didn't get depressed 2 years before. I got depressed when I perceived them as missing. And that's important, because a person could have experienced the loss quite a while before, but only because something more recent happened is the perception of the loss. So it's when you perceive the loss, and then immediately you perceive the loss, your system goes into depression. It's what it is designed to do. The symptoms of the depression are designed to pull you out of your environment. You lose energy, so you're depressed. That's not when you're going to run the marathon, or go and work on the car, or go and plant a field of corn, or the loss of energy. It pulls you out of your environment. Loss of interest shuts off all interest, pulls you back into yourself. And the sadness over the loss, forcing you to reflect on the loss and come to terms with it. It's very purposeful. There's nothing unpurposeful about it. And then, ideally, if you allow yourself to be depressed, allow this experience, you come to a point when you release the loss and the depression recovers. Now, in what happens, that's the idea. In practice, what happens is, We experience a loss, we start to go into a depression, and about half, just a little way down to the depression, we respond, but we don't like the depressed feeling, we don't want to own up to it, we haven't figured out quite how it fits into our spiritual experience, you see. So we have this negative view of depression as Christians. So we decide, no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to short-circuit it. This is what I mean by short-circuiting. I'm going to short-circuit it. I'm just going to ignore it, or I'm going to rush out and replace the loss. I mean, that's the easiest, isn't it? So a person gets divorced, husband walks out on the wife. She's starting to get depressed. Well, I'm just going to go out and find another husband, replace the loss. It's short circuiting. I had a patient once. She was a Catholic. Had been a nun, and then she left the nunnery and became a nurse and. I'd say a very troubled person. She'd got into an affair with a priest who is now way up the top of the hierarchy, and so she left the nunnery and she went into nursing, and then she works the night shift. All her life she's worked night shift, so she avoids people. She has this cat, this adorable Persian kitten. That's her little child. I mean, she just adores it. And one day she took it into the vet for some minor surgery, and it died on the operating table. So she called up and said, I've got to come and see you. I really am falling apart. My beautiful cat has died. And why don't you? I came in, I sat down, and I said, well, we've got some grief work to do here. I said, now, what I don't want you to do is to go out and buy another kitten. Okay? Don't short-circuit it. She didn't believe me. Comes in the next week, big smile on her face, doesn't feel depressed anymore. She'd gone out that week and she'd bought a new kitten. I said, you've just aborted an opportunity to grow, to heal. No, I've got a new kitten and I'm, 2 weeks later, another phone call from her, because she didn't feel the need to see me. 2 weeks later, I get this phone call. She's in a terrible state. This little kitten she bought is a holy terror. It's ripped all her cushions, pulled her curtains down. It had a serious stomach ailment and was pooping all over the place. She's ready to strangle it. She said, I realize now I've made a mistake. But what can I do? She said, take the kitten back. Yeah, some people are so stupid. What can I do? Take the kitten back to where you bought it and ask for a refund. Really? Yeah, really. Got her money and she came back. And then we worked the next 4 or 5 months doing some grief work. And finally, it was about 6 months, finally, one day she sat up and said, you know, now I'm ready. Now I'm ready. Short-circuiting. You can't short-circuit. We try to short-circuit when we say to ourselves, you know, I shouldn't be depressed. I shouldn't let this little thing get to me. And on and on and on. That's short-circuiting. Now, when you short-circuit, what happens is, you notice the way I've drawn this, there's a fairly short period of time involved if you allow yourself the full expression. If you prolong it like this, if you short-circuit it, then you prolong the depression. That's the problem. Never gets resolved, you prolong it, until finally forgetting, which is a great healer. I mean, God has designed our mind so that we forget things. But it's just, finally the mind says, that's it, you know, you're not mature enough to deal with the real issue here. We'll just take it, we'll erase it a little bit so you can get on with your life. Problem is, you've stored up something that might be re-triggered again at a later point. There's a clear, several laws that I just want to mention that are very helpful to understand. There is a clear relationship between short-circuiting and the length of the depression, which is another way of saying that for every loss there is an appropriate amount of depression, and the best way to think of the appropriate amount of depression is to think of it in terms of time. When I get a traffic ticket, I think of it as a 24-hour depression. If I have an argument with my wife, that's a 3-day depression. And it's very helpful. Give yourself a period of time and say, I'm going to allow myself this period of time to grieve this loss. And when it's finished, get up, move forward, go ahead. So the steps that I outline, and I need to just cover them fairly quickly for you now. The first step, dealing with reactive depression, point 18, recognize the depression. You don't recognize the depression, you can't even begin the healing process. Secondly, identify the loss. Now, what can be helpful is, you see under 16, I have types of losses, concrete losses, abstract losses. The first, it's very helpful to ask yourself, is this a concrete loss or an abstract loss? Concrete loss is real tangible. If you can pay for it, it's a concrete loss. Abstract losses. I remember the day my middle daughter was my first daughter to get married. And about a week before the marriage, I could feel this depression. Loss. Daughter was getting married. You know, people say to you, well, you're gaining a son-in-law. Nonsense! A son-in-law, he doesn't equate to, is not equivalent to losing a daughter. You know, you just go away, those sorts of things. But that's an abstract loss. It's difficult to get a handle on that. Very difficult. And each of those breaks down to real imagined threat. Now, the thing about imagined losses is there's nothing to grieve. So imagined losses must be converted to real losses, otherwise dump them. You convert imagined losses to real losses. You test reality. A patient came in once, a man I was seeing. Wonderful guy, beautiful guy. And I've been seeing him about another problem. He came in one day and he looked depressed and I said, what's the problem? He said, well, you know, I've not been feeling well the last couple of weeks. Not feeling well. And he said, the problem is that I remember my father going through exactly the same thing I'm going through now. And it turned out that he had leukemia and he died from it. And I'm just afraid that maybe I've got the same symptoms. I said, so what are you going to do about it? Well, I'm afraid to go to the doctor. If I go to the doctor and I find I have leukemia, what am I going to do? I said, if you've got leukemia, it's not going to make any difference whether you know about it or not. You know, it's going to happen. We can't live in fantasy. We can only live with reality. God has designed us to live in touch with reality. So I have this negative thing towards positive thinking. I'm negative about positive thinking. possibility thing. Has any of Schuller's stuff come here? Oh, I can tell you some stories about Robert Schuller. He's a nice guy. I mean, I like him as a person. But you know, possibility thinking. Once I heard him preach. He was saying, the Mary, the mother of Jesus, was the mother of Jesus because she was a possibility thinker. Mary no more wanted to be a mother than I want to be. Possibility thinker? No, you know, I wrote a book years ago called The Success Factor. And my point is that it's reality thinking that God calls us to. Now, it just so happens that most of us are too negative. And our negative thinking is not reality either. So, you know, in the sense, if some of us started thinking realistically, maybe we'd move from being negative to being more positive. But it's reality thinking. This man, finally convinced him he had to go and see the doctor right away, and it was 3 weeks or so before I saw him again, and he came in, and he looked pleased, he looked happy. So I thought to myself, well, you see, we tested reality, and it's okay. And I said to him, well, how did it go? He said, well, I was right. Doctor says, I have leukemia, got about 6 months to live. He said, but I feel better. I feel better. And so we spent the next 6 months doing grief therapy, in preparing him for his own death. And there were wonderful months. This went not down, miserable. This was a man who had lived a good life and could celebrate that. But we can only live with reality. But you see, we must test. If it's a real loss, now we can deal with it. As long as it's imagined, there's no grief. And threatened losses are even worse. Because we've got to have experienced the loss. So you've got to convert it to a real loss if you can't dump it. But let's assume that it is a real loss. And we now have to discover the real meaning of the loss. And I need to do this quickly, but see if you can grasp this. And I can always come back this evening. This afternoon I'm going to participate a little bit with my wife towards the end of her session. So I won't have time to come back to this, but I could touch on it again this evening if it's not clear. But imagine that this whole loss thing is like a funnel. A loss funnel. And that the experience of the loss, that we've got all these marbles in this funnel, see? And the depression, dealing with the depression, it's a slow process of trying to identify what the losses are. Now, every significant life event has many facets to the loss. Take divorce. A wife who is being divorced by her husband. What are some of the losses? Call them out for me. Companionship. Loss of companionship. Security. Loss of security. Excuse me? Loss of self-esteem. Rejection. Financial losses, I mean, every divorced woman goes into a new poverty class, right? Loss of friends, loss of married friends. One of my daughter's first experiences was that her husband is now dead. All her married friends were shunning her because she's single again. And married couples don't tolerate divorced or widowed people very well. What's that? Yeah, lots of children often, you know, lots of visiting rights and so on. So you can see that every life event has dozens and dozens of facets to the loss. Now, the thing about grief is that one is not grieving all of these things. Some are more important than others. But it is very helpful to think that there is usually one loss represented that is gumming up the whole works. There is in every life event that is a loss, a key issue that for us encapsulates all the other issues. And that if we can only get it out into our awareness, if we can only become conscious of it, we can do our grieving. God helps us to put it in perspective. And that is what we try to discover. When we're counseling with somebody who is depressed, we spend months exploring all the different facets of the loss, trying to find it. But there is one key issue. And if you can get that out into the open, you can say, aha, that's what I have lost. The moment you see the depression, the grief is a quest to find what it is that's missing. Divorce is too general a category to grieve. And I'm simplified by saying one. There may be two or three others as well. But there's this key one we've got to go through. Now let me tell you the story. And then we'll bring our morning session to a close. And I will probably just take a moment to wrap up a few thoughts. But this will illustrate the point that I'm trying to make. Some years ago, I needed to buy a new car. I've always bought used cars. Buy them 1 year old. Someone else takes the depreciation. I can fix cars. I don't care if it's not perfect. So this year my wife said, oh, go buy a new car. You've never had a new car. Come buy a new one. All the other cars you buy don't usually smell nice. New cars smell nice. Go buy a new car. Oh, fine, if you say so, honey. And I went shopping Saturday afternoon. And there it was. It was parked on the curbside waiting for me. Last one of the model. It was silver, black stripe, turbocharged, two-door, sporty. And I looked at it and I fell in love with it. Went in. I hate used car salesmen. I must actually give you my list of hate. But used car salesmen are up there high. And I had, but it was a nice guy, I liked the guy, and we negotiated, and he dropped the price, and got a deal. And I drove it home that afternoon, fried, oh, I just loved this thing. 1 week later, I was driving downtown Pasadena, had to go upstairs to take care of some business, came down, got in my car, started the engine, moved forward, oh, 18 inches. Well, no more than 2 feet, okay? And I turned to see if the traffic was clear, but I'd moved forward enough that a guard in his truck coming down the road touched the front bumper and the whole front end fell into the street. 1 week after I, first time in my life, I bought a new car. Got out, and the truck stopped, the guy got out. He was obviously an illegal alien. It was what we call them south of the border. He wouldn't have had insurance. I mean, it's impossible. He didn't even have a driver's license. I said to him, take your truck and go. It's my fault. No damage to your truck. Just go. I'll take care of it. I picked up all the pieces, put it in the trunk of my car, boot of my car, drove home. Deep depression. That night, I was to teach a seminar at a local Anglican church. They were having a bit of a festival. I was going to teach a seminar on depression. And yet I am depressed. I say, oh, well. So that night, large group of people, and I was outlining to them a model of depression, the grief model, and loss. You know, you've got to discover what it is you've lost. And it's different for different people. Divorce is different for different people. Pastors who leave churches, it's different. You've got to know what it is. Then you get it in the open. God's created us so that it automatically we let it go. And I said, well, now I need you to know, I had an accident this afternoon and I'm depressed tonight because my nice brand new car, silver, black stripe, turbocharged, two door, whole front end, smashed. I said, I don't know what it is I've lost. Had an accident. That doesn't help. You be my therapist, I said. You help me. And one guy raised his hand and said, oh, it's going to cost you a lot of money. I said, no. I've talked to insurance. I've already taken the car in for repair. Insurance says they'll cover it. I'm in the insurance business. It's going to cost you a lot of money. I said, well, thanks very much. Insurance says, they're going to jack up my insurance is what they're going to do next time around. I said, well, yeah, you're probably right. But that, you know, that doesn't, if you could pay for it, usually it's no big deal. Even if you can't afford it. I mean, money It's the stuff you can't pay for. That's the real stuff. And someone else said, well, you know, you've got to go and tell your wife. And that's true. I had to go and tell my wife I'd had an accident. Now, she and I have this thing about who's the better driver, who's had fewer traffic tickets. I've got to go and eat humble pie. Well, she was nice. It was at least 5 minutes before she rubbed it in. And, you know, and it was an interesting experience. I was genuine. I was wanting to illustrate the grief model. And I didn't really think I'd get it. But the lady sitting at the back on my left, at the back, raised her hand. And she said these words. That car will never, ever be perfect again. And I burst out crying. She'd put her finger on that. That was the issue. That's what I was grieving, that issue. That this perfect car that I'd fallen in love with would never be perfect again. I remember going to the repair shop and I said to the guy, I want every part replaced. No panel beating, no knocking or bending, no repainting. I want the original factory paint on every single part. You replace every part with a brand new part. And even then, it would never be perfect again. And I just felt the depression lift. And 2 weeks later, when I went to fetch that car, I went to the front of it and I stood and I paused there after I paid the guy and I was all by myself. And I said, Lord, I just want to spend a few minutes with you. I repent. I turned this into a god. I worshipped it. It's just four wheels and a motor to get me from place to place. I said, thank you, Lord. You have held up a mirror to my soul. I've seen a glimpse of myself that I hadn't seen before. Forgive me. You see, depression is a healing emotion. It holds up a mirror. We get to see ourselves better than we ever see ourselves in any other way. Don't tell me that depression isn't a healing emotion. And I got in that car, and I've driven it many years after that. Sold it to my son-in-law eventually. But from that moment on, it was never a problem again. Let me read to you in closing, and then I'll come back this evening and wrap this up because our time is gone. Let me read to you those few words from Philippians chapter 3, verse 7. But whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things and consider them to be rubbish. Do you know what? I honestly believe that the Apostle Paul came to the place in his life where he said, I'm doing my grieving ahead of time. I've given it up. There's nothing you can take away from me anymore. And there's a sense in which depression, that's the goal to which it moves us. The point where we give it up. Gladly. Because it's nothing compared to what Christ has to give us. God bless you.